Everyone in the matter of JK versus the New Jersey State Parole Board. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
James Maynor representing appellant JK.
Stephanie Lutz on behalf of Amicus Curiae, New Jersey Office of the Public Defender.
Assistant Attorney General Jane C. Schuster on behalf of the New Jersey State Parole Board.
Welcome, counsel. Ms. Schuster, I want to start with a couple of questions of you to help us get a better understanding of the policy and procedure document dated March 25th, 2020, offender requests to reside outside of the United States of America. Just a little bit about its status and its timing. This, according to the document, was approved on March 25th, 2020, and it is signed by the chair of the parole board. When did the Attorney General's office learn about this policy? You're muted. Could you please unmute?
Sorry, Your Honor. So it's in terms of this policy, it's my understanding that it's an internal policy.
When did the Attorney General's office learn about this policy?
I don't know the exact date that the Attorney General's office learned about the policy.
Can you tell us approximately when?
It's entirely possible. I can certainly provide that information in a letter to the court after I can find out. But it's my understanding that it's under, it's not currently being used. It's under review based on the court's ruling in this particular case. And so it's not an active policy.
Does that mean the designation of approval suggests naturally that it is something that went into effect? Is that accurate? Set aside what may have happened afterwards. Did this go into effect on or about March 25th, 2020?
Yes, the information that you have about the document is correct, that it was an internal policy that was signed by the parole board to use, but it has not since provided, there's no other cases, there's no transfer requests have been approved based on that policy, and it's currently under review because...
What does that mean? If you could just help us understand, it is an existing policy that is being looked at, or does it have some other meaning?
It is an existing policy that at this time is not being used to consider requests waiting for this court's opinion in this matter, because the board has now realized that it does not feel that it has the authority to use this policy or any other policy to allow for an international transfer.
Can you explain to us what happened since March 25th, 2020?
Yes,
when did it fall under review? When was it called into question?
So it was when the Public Defender's Office, in this case, filed its amicus brief, because the public defender specifically asked this court to order the board to promulgate regulations, that in looking at what the authority was to promulgate those regulations, it became apparent that there was no statutory authority for those regulations. And so the board took a step back and at that time, sort of shifted gears so as to not run afoul of its agency authority.
I know you didn't handle this case from the start, so these are not questions pointed toward you personally, but can you explain why the document was not provided to the court until very, very recently?
I was aware that there was an internal policy that was considered not binding, but it's just something internally that the office was following, but I personally did not have a copy of it. And I think also because it's an internal policy until just recently, sorry, but because it's an internal policy that was not that was not being, that rather than formal regulations, that's why there wasn't a need to provide it to the court, is my understanding.
Was the document made public at around the time it was approved?
I don't know, Your Honor. I'd be happy to get further details about this particular policy and provide further information in a letter to the court.
It doesn't indicate that it's an internal policy. That's what I'm puzzled by your answer.
I understand, Your Honor. It's not my understanding that it's published on a website. But I could be incorrect about that. I honestly, Your Honor, I apologize. I don't know the answer to that question.
Again, I'm not suggesting any bad faith on your part at all. We're just trying to understand. This is a document that, as you said, appears to be at odds with the position the Attorney General has taken in this case. We will grant Mr. Maynard's motion to supplement the record with this document and may refer to it during the course of argument. So we'll come back and speak with you about the merits of the case a little bit later. Thank you, Ms. Schuster.
I understand. Thank you.
Mr. Maynard, please go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. At the outset, I would like to point out that the Division of Parole has already utilized the new policy to deny one of my other clients' request for international transfer, citing the 7-year eligibility provision of the policy.
When was that done?
That was a couple of months ago, and I could get all the particulars. I don't want to divulge because it's a confidential, it's a CSL. Megan's Law matter, but the country was Pakistan, and the initials are AK. And of course,
please go ahead.
I could certainly get all the information. I'm sure I could secure authorization.
Please go ahead with your argument.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. The relief that is sought today is the right of a CSL offender to transfer residence to his native country. The issues in this case are serious. They are constitutional and fundamental in nature. But they take on an even greater importance because of globalization, the ever-increasing speed of travel and mass migration of people, both documented and undocumented. A substantial percentage of CSL offenders in New Jersey, under the supervision of the Division of Parole, are not native to this country or have a legal right of residence in another country. That's the context of JK, who was born in Poland and is a dual citizen. His family, native language, and native culture are all in Poland. He has a right of return under the Polish Constitution that cannot be denied or rescinded, no matter what crime may have been committed in the United States. My argument will be extremely limited. I will address only the 4 critical issues that provide the legal basis of my client's right to return to his native country, even though he is subject to CSL in New Jersey, and even though he may not be subject to supervision in Poland. The 4 critical points are, first, the right of a CSL offender to return to his native country is guaranteed by the United States Constitution, federal law, and international treaties. Second, when a CSL offender exercises the right to leave the USA, the citizens of New Jersey are better protected. The offender's rehabilitation is advanced. Third, while the effect of CSL, as found by courts, is punitive, the intent, as expressed by the legislature, is remedial. Fourth, different treatment of CSL offenders who are U.S. citizens versus those who are not violates this state's equal protection guarantees. Point one, it is important to recognize that the right of return and travel of a CSL offender to his native country is a liberty interest. It is recognized under the United States Constitution arising from the Fifth Amendment as decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in Kent v. Dulles. It is also codified in federal law under section 1999, subsection 3955, quote, the right of expatriation is a natural and inherent right of all people. The rights of return and travel are also protected by international law. The United States is a signatory to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Paragraphs 2 and 4 of Article 12 of the ICCPR state, everyone shall be free to leave any country, including his own. And no one shall be arbitrarily deprived of the right to enter his own country. Point 2. Allowing the right of return advances the legislative intent of CSL. The legislative purpose of CSL is clearly stated in Public Law 1994, Chapter 130, Section 2B. Quote, to protect the public and foster rehabilitation, unquote. One of the shortest legislative statements I've ever seen. By public, the citizens of New Jersey, Sanchez v. New Jersey State Parole has clarified that by public, the citizens of New Jersey is what's being referenced and what is being intended by the legislature. Regarding protection, if JK or a CSL offender is living in Poland, the citizens of New Jersey are better protected. No system of supervision guarantees perfect protection. CSL offenders in New Jersey can circumvent their conditions of supervision. However, New Jersey citizens are substantially better protected if CSL offenders are living outside of the United States rather than down the block or rather than in the next county. A CSL offender living in a foreign country offers complete protection from contact sexual offense. The Registrant Risk Assessment Scale, the RAS, which is the instrument that has been adopted by the state of New Jersey to evaluate sex offense risk, indicates that physical offenses are more serious than internet or non-contact offenses. Regarding rehabilitation, rehabilitation is better promoted if CSL offenders are living in their native country and are able to be supported by their family, employment, community support, cultural familiarity, and native language. So the dual purpose of CSL is advanced by allowing the transfer of residence to one's native country. It better protects the citizens of New Jersey, and it advances the rehabilitation of the offender. Point 3, CSL is remedial in intent, but punitive in effect. It's critical to assess the intent of CSL because intent of the legislature and of the statutory scheme determines the rights of the offender and also the standard for restricting those rights. In prior cases, such as Hester, Schubert, and Perez, this court referred to CSL as a, quote, penal statute. However, in each case, this court was assessing the effects of CSL in the context of ex post facto protections. Careful legal analysis of the intent of CSL reveals that it is remedial. The only purpose stated by the legislature when CSL was enacted was to protect the public and foster rehabilitation. That's in section 2B. In Jamochian, this court explicitly found that the purpose of CSL was, quote, not to punish, but rather to protect the public and promote rehabilitation. Jamochian at page 246. So remedial statutes focus on protection of the public and rehabilitation. CSL has none of the attributes of punitive statutes, such as punishment, retribution, or incapacitation. Contrary to the state's claim, CSL is not parole. The CSL statute states clearly, CSL begins, quote, upon completion of the sentence imposed. And CSL offenders are supervised as if on parole. If it were parole, in fact, it couldn't be supervised as if on parole. It's important to bear in mind that CSL offenders are not incarcerated or being punished. The parole board is not the CSL offender's jailer. And New Jersey is not their prison because CSL offenders have already paid their debt of punishment and also because CSL is grounded in a remedial purpose.
Mr. Maynard, may I ask you a question?
Yes.
Would you like concede that a defendant such as yours does not have an absolute right of return? For instance, if he's committed a crime and he's imprisoned, he can't demand his release from prison because he has a right of return to his native country.
I agree with that. When someone is subject to the punishment phase of a statutory provision or a sentence, and they're actually being subjected to punishment, that does not permit the right of return. However, I would point out that the legislature has adopted a statutory provision for the transfer of offenders that was also approved in state.
So I understand that. So there are restrictions. This case also implicates international relations. So another country, even if it has a right of return, may have laws, I don't know about Poland's, about waiver of that. If they may have laws, I'm going to ask you if you know about this, whether or not if a sex offender is coming into their country, who has been declared a sex offender in another country, whether or not the legal authorities have to be contacted, whatever governmental authorities have to be contacted. So beyond this right of return, do you know what requirements Polish law has in place for returning citizens who have been convicted in another country of a sex offense and who are under some sort of parole supervision in another country? Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Justice Alvin. I'm pretty familiar with international Megan's law and all of those provisions. And I've, based on this and a couple other cases, have tried to familiarize myself with those various international provisions. And the bottom line is, in a case where there's a right of return like Poland, Israel, and a number of other states, the right of return trumps the normal exclusions that would occur or impediments to entering the country that a non-citizen, non-right of return person would have. So if a tourist who is not a Polish citizen wanted to go visit Poland, and under international Megan's law, Homeland Security in the United States would let Poland know that that individual planned to enter the country, Poland may very well exclude that individual or limit their presence.
But Mr. Maynard, in this particular case, as I understand it, Poland has no criteria for this at all. He would be unsupervised. Is that correct?
Well, that's referring to the provisions for supervision if someone was to live in Poland. And I'm not...
Am I wrong about that? That there would be no criteria, no provisions?
I'm not 100% sure, but what I have been able to ascertain, Poland was one of the first chemical castration countries for sex offense matters, and they have some pretty stringent provisions for how they treat sex offense in their country.
As I understand this case, there are none, though, but which leads to my second question. Initially, you said that it promoted the New Jersey's goal of public safety. Obviously, if he's in Poland, people here are pretty safe. But yeah. You also said it advanced rehabilitation. If there are no conditions, no of any kind, how did that advance rehabilitation?
Yes, by being in one's native country, one's native culture, having extended family support, having more appropriate counseling services that can be done in one's native language, all of those.
How would that be more appropriate than those in the state? Do you have a basis for that statement?
They have.
Tell me what they are over there that are more appropriate than here.
Yes, yes, Justice Fernandez, and you. They have well-trained psychologists, certified.
Don't we have those here also?
We do have them here, of course. And individuals like JK, many of whom have already completed their sex offense, successfully completed and have been discharged from their sex offense counseling requirements in the United States or New Jersey, they have access to psychological services in their countries, in their native language, with cultural sensitivity.
Mr. Maynard, have you contacted any authorities in Poland, law enforcement or judicial authorities, to see what sort of notification is required before an American sex offender CSL person is transferred to Poland. Have you done any of that?
Yeah, what we've done is we contacted the consulate. I tried to get some sense of who the law enforcement authorities were that in charge of the state law enforcement authorities. And I really, other than the consulate specifically telling us after disclosure of JK's offense information, other than the consulate saying there is a right to return that, and he has the right to return. Other than that, I was not able to get any specifics about, you know, supervision requirements that would be imposed on him if he moved back there. Now, that's that country's right to assess. They have been informed of JK's offense history. And I would
I'm trying to get to a more granular detail, but you're asking that he go to a particular town, province, area. But if the person were in the United States, the authorities would have to be notified. If there were parole supervision there, those authorities would have to be notified. Have you made any like inquiry of that type as a prerequisite to your motion to have your client return to Poland?
Yes, through my client, I asked him to contact a lawyer in Poland and to try to ascertain.
Not through your client.
Through
you or some reliable source. And one of the reasons why I'm asking this, mm-hmm. in our record, the statements of family members, potential employers, none of them have been reduced to some form of attestation, as far as I know, or sworn statement. These are some bunch like letters that have been submitted. That doesn't seem to me that the type of information that should be forwarded to the parole authorities in this country to act upon. Like how do they know that the people who sign these letters are actually the people who sign them? And I'm asking these questions is whether or not you can delegate to your client the type of inquiries that need to be made and which the authorities in this country have to rely upon. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't think this is one of the unique aspects of the international context versus the interstate context. I do a lot of work with interstate transfers under the Interstate Compact, and we are able to get all sorts of information, notarized statements, have the authorities in the other state inspect the residents and do all that. In the international context, to be very blunt, it is very difficult and many times impossible. Think of all the countries and all the different various states of development all these countries are in. It's very hard, even though I did make diligent attempts to find out who the chief law enforcement officer was and get and have access to an attorney in Poland to try to help figure some of this stuff out from my curiosity about what would happen. But this is why we do have to, I think very frankly and bluntly, approach this matter and with asking whether or not we are going to require some type of supervision regime in the foreign country. I don't think that there's two things
before you move on, I want to follow up because you made a statement earlier, Mr. Maynard, that if JK is permitted to go to Poland, people in New Jersey, the public generally is better off. Part of the purpose of supervision and monitoring and knowing where someone is and the conditions under which they're living is to be sure that we know what he's doing. And if he were to return to New Jersey, the New Jersey officials would be able to protect the New Jersey people who might be affected by his return. Supervision in another country as well as in another state is important, not just for the people who live next door to him in Poland, but it also allows for the long range planning of any future moves that JK might make that could impact the people of New Jersey. So when Justice Albin is asking about unsworn statements that JK has submitted to the parole board, they're meaningful because an application is being made before a public entity, just like it would for a court. And if you're asking for relief from an ongoing order, there has to be a verifiable basis to permit proper review of that. Wouldn't you agree?
Justice LaVecchia, I take your point, and I do have something I'd like to respond. It'll take just a second. The one exception that we have under Sanchez, remember Sanchez, and that logic says you can't deny the right of someone to go to the foreign jurisdiction based on the lack of potential lack of supervision. But it does, JS and Sanchez do say that there is, the parole board may make a change in residence subject to conditions to protect the public and foster rehabilitation. Now, it's important to understand that protection of the public means protective conditions to the, for the citizens of New Jersey. So only to the extent that they impact the citizens of New Jersey, such as, to your point, requiring an offender to agree that if they intend to return to the United States, that they give prior notice to the Division of Parole. That would be an acceptable condition. And any conditions that they make, that the Division of Parole does make for the protection of the citizens in New Jersey or rehabilitation of the offender must be reasonably in balance with the rights related to travel and return.
So can I ask you a question about that? Did you raise the constitutional right to travel argument before the appellate division? Because I thought this appeal was taken on the basis that the decision was arbitrary and capricious, not on a constitutional basis.
I believe we took, since the very early part of this case, right to travel, right to return, and those fundamental rights.
That's not what the appellate division decision says. It says that JK was arguing that it's arbitrary and capricious and was quarreling with JK's refusal to submit any additional documentation, I presume under the advice of counsel, when the case was remanded from the appellate division the first time to the parole board. Am I mistaken about that?
I don't think that the appellate division decision treated the entirety of our arguments or issues. I think that they delivered a per curiam decision that did not, in fact, encompass the entirety of our record or our case. Or
did
our
JK submit any additional information to the parole board when it was remanded after the first appellate division decision?
No, the reason that we didn't submit any additional information is because the parole board was asking JK to propose how he would be supervised in Poland, not upon his return to New Jersey. And under Sanchez, it was our position that the state may not impose such a requirement on JK, especially that JK should be the architect of his own supervision requirement.
So JK stonewalled the parole board, and that's how the case comes back up to the appellate division.
I would prefer to say that instead of stonewall, it wasn't that. We tried to be extremely cooperative in all aspects to the Division of Parole, but it's just—
this is what I'm having problems with, and I hope you can answer this. I don't understand why you are reluctant to provide verified statements from the so-called people in Poland who are willing to employ your client or willing to house your client. I just don't get that. How are the authorities in New Jersey just supposed to rely upon a piece of paper that has a signature?
I'm not against that. And I something like providing whatever that country's form of verification of a document is, a notary.
No, us. We have.
I'm sorry?
The verification that the parole board requires, and that does not seem to me to be unreasonable. They don't want a piece of paper with just a signature on it. They want to make certain that the people who are signing are really the people whose signature appears on that.
My answer, I'm sorry, my answer
some just form of attestation, verification, or whatever.
Yes, whatever form of verification we can get from those countries, and they're different, I'm all for. And in terms of residence, in terms of if there's some family support, things like that are fine. That's not the problem. And in fact, there's a difference between the conditions for eligibility to leave and go to the other country to reside versus conditions of supervision in those countries. There are a number of very reasonable conditions that could be required to become eligible to make a transfer, for parole to approve a transfer, some of which is verified identities of individuals they'll be living with, locations where they'll be living, and so on. Also, conditions that would provide that when an offender seeks to return, that they must give prior notice of their intent to come back to the United States. And also even something like a verification schedule once a year or once every 180 days, as the parole policy currently has it, to do a video conference. There are a plethora of reasonable conditions that are related to the eligibility to go there. But when it gets to who's going to supervise, exactly what conditions are going to be required, it becomes much more difficult. You're in a foreign jurisdiction.
That burden seems to be on you. You're making the request. The United States is a good citizen in the world. Before it sends a convicted sex offender to another country, it would seem that the appropriate authorities in that foreign country should be advised. And if there's a question of who should be contacted, I would think that the burden should be on you. You're making the request for the removal.
For the record, Justice Albin, I 100% agree with what you just said. And advising the foreign country of the details of the offense history, the existence and the nature and the details of the offense history, and the fact that the person is under supervision by the New Jersey Division of Parole, are all things that we've suggested in our papers and to the Division of Parole that should be required as a condition of eligibility. We agree that we should be a good citizen, and that we should do this, a reasonable disclosure and transparency about the offense history, all prior to being eligible, as part of the eligibility for the transfer. So I agree with that, Justice Albin.
Mr. Maynard, the policy that you submitted has pages of qualifications, of requirements in connection with an application of the parole board. You mentioned in your submission to the court that there wasn't time, given when you received it, to seek a remand to attempt to abide by this policy in front of the parole board. What relief are you seeking now?
Well, Your Honor, I'm still seeking essentially the relief that I've asked for, but I was, of course, look, I just received this policy. I've read it. I haven't had a chance to study it. I was impressed. I thought it was a really great effort at putting together a real policy that could be useful in these situations. I wish they had allowed a dialogue to occur, or, I wish I make many requests to have input in with the state and with Division of Parole and other agencies about sex offense law matters. If we'd sat down together, I would be optimistic that we could iron out something that would really work and be constitutionally palatable. And for example, I have a little initial sheet of things that I wrote up. This policy is a major step in the right direction, but there are a couple things that would have to be changed to pass constitutional muster, just two of which, for example, so you understand what I'm saying, is some eligibility and supervision requirements, which differentiate between parolees with and without sex offenses, would have to be changed to satisfy equal protection concerns. And for substantive due process purposes, the rights of foreign nationals with dual citizenship would have to be looked at, because there are requirements that need to differentiate a fundamental right of return from just a right of international travel. So I think with not too much additional work, if the Division of Parole were somewhat flexible in saying in their in the way that they look at eligibility. For example, sex offenders would have to wait 7 years to become eligible. Normal parolees would have only have to wait 2 years. There's no reason for that. The recidivism rate of sex offenders is lower than normal parolees.
I don't think it's appropriate for us today to try to iron out what may or may not be constitutional issues relating to this policy. So I was just asking what your relief was.
It did pique my interest, though, and I was motivated to start thinking about how it could be done. And I do think, just for the record, that we're close. The relief I'm requesting, Your Honor, is that the fundamental and constitutional rights of my client not be frustrated by the concerns that parole has about whether or not as it has statutory authority, or whether or not my client will be supervised, or in what exact manner in the foreign jurisdiction. At this stage of development of the law, and without parole actually implementing their policy or withdrawing implementation, my client has a right of return to his country. He's made full disclosure of his offense background. His country invites him to come back. Any reasonable condition of assuring where he's going to live with a notarized statement, and that he will advise parole if he intends to return to the United States, are easily satisfied. And so I would the relief I'm requesting, Your Honor, is that he be allowed to undertake that reasonable approach to transfer of his residence, which places his rights, fundamental rights, in harmony with any considerations of the protection of the citizens of New Jersey and his rehabilitation. I sense that you'd like me to come to a conclusion. So if that's the case, I'll skip ahead to my conclusion, Your Honor. In the final analysis, there are three core principles that are presented by this case. First is the right of return to one's country, and that is fundamental. So second, the petition for international transfer of residence may not be denied based on issues of supervision while in a foreign jurisdiction. And third, any conditions that may be imposed on an international transfer of residence must be for the protection of New Jersey citizens and harmonized with the constitutional and fundamental rights related to the freedom of travel and the right of return. JK's petition has established a good cause basis for international transfer of his residence. It comports with the overall purpose of Megan's Law. It protects the citizens of New Jersey by eliminating the possibility of the most serious kinds of sexual offense involving physical contact. And it fosters rehabilitation because he will have the support, verifiable, of an extended family, emotional comfort of his native language and culture, and expanded employment opportunities. So,
and I do believe JK have family here, counselor?
He has limited family. He has a very elderly father and mother. The vast bulk of his family is in Poland.
How long was he a resident of the United States or of New Jersey? For how long?
I want to say for over 20 years.
Over 20 years?
Yeah, he's a long-term resident, Your Honor, if that's...
Did he come to America as a child, as I recall?
I don't know the exact age, but
I thought he was seven.
I want to say it was, and around there.
And he's 41 now? Is he 41 now?
Yes. And he's been successful here. He's gotten a PhD in pharmacy, and he's done well. He is able to function here. I'm not saying he can't function. I'm not saying he can't get counseling. He's done all that. But a right of return is not necessarily about that. I do think an individual's native or country or place where they have a right of residence can offer a good deal of emotional, psychological, rehabilitative benefit to an individual. And we shouldn't try to really second guess that. I think that the essential if we distill all of this to its essential element, we're talking about the harmonization of individuals' rights that have been recognized as fundamental and truly deep-seated rights to travel and to return to places. And we have to harmonize that with what the law currently says about the countervailing interest. And the countervailing interest is the safety of the citizens of New Jersey and, of course, rehabilitation. And that's where...
In connection with that, mm-hmm. A number of the issues that's arisen for your client in connection with his CSL was his inability to comply with his restricted internet access. So if he thus go to a foreign country and is not being supervised, internet access, inappropriate internet access, is not limited to his physical location in Poland. You know, do you acknowledge that there is some New Jersey connection to its desire to maintain or monitor his ability to adhere to those conditions that he's been living under for a while now, but not without some difficulty?
Yes, and that applies equally to CSL offenders in New Jersey that are easily able to circumvent those restrictions. But the internet access issue with my client was not, in fact, that he was out searching for doing anything sexually inappropriate or searching for victims. And it wasn't even really getting on the internet. What it was in his recent issue was trying to make a living by selling used internet devices. And the vast majority of CSL violations are in fact technical and not related to sex offense recidivism. And they're related more to seeing to family, to travel to visit family, travel for work, or failure to comply with a technical requirement like registration. The fact of the matter is sexual recidivism and the danger of sexual crime is very, very low for sex offenders. And the situation of an individual sex offender being in Poland rather than around the block and committing some type of offense is that at least the person in Poland can't then walk around the block after making internet contact and commit a physical offense. So it's not a perfect world. And it's going to be, you know, I said there's an improved safety. It's not a perfect safety. And it's not a perfect safety for CSL people in New Jersey. It's not. But at
Anything
least,
you'd like?
I'm sorry.
Please finish your sentence.
Sorry. I think on balance, the citizens of New Jersey do experience an enhancement of their protection. I think there is an enhancement of rehabilitation. And I think when you counterbalance that or try to harmonize that with the very important and fundamental and well-recognized rights involved, I think on balance, we must find a way to allow the larger, ever-growing number of migratory populations that will find themselves on CSL in New Jersey. We must do something to facilitate those important rights of travel and return and not frustrate them in a de facto sense by a de facto denial by insisting on excessive supervision requirements when they're not even in this country.
Other questions for Mr. Maynard, anyone? Thank you, counsel. Ms. Lutz.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The New Jersey Office of the Public Defender supports petitioner's position that individuals supervised under CSL and PSL should be permitted to return to their home country with minimal oversight from the receiving country, and perhaps with supervision from the New Jersey State Parole Board. If this court finds that the parole board can supervise individuals under CSL and PSL living abroad, we simply ask the court to order the board to adopt objective regulations in this area. Formal objective regulations surrounding international moves will ensure that the board's decisions are made consistently and that they're not arbitrary. Further, formal regulations would provide crucial notice to supervised individuals so that they know in advance what is required of them if they wish to move abroad. And Ms. Lodge, finally,
make your last point, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor. Finally, an order from this court requiring formal regulations in this area would clarify that it's not the responsibility of the supervised individual to devise his or her own supervision plan, that is under the purview of the parole board. Doing that will ensure consistent, non-arbitrary decisions in this area.
Sorry for interrupting you earlier. There's an air of artificiality about this argument because the relief that you're requesting, that we order the parole board to adopt regulations and a policy, appears to be what they've done in this 31-page document. Would you care to respond and give us your thoughts about where we are right now?
Yes, Your Honor, and I certainly understand the court's inquiry in this area. When we devised this argument, we understood that the parole board was in the process of creating these regulations. However, we were unable to ascertain whether those regulations were formally adopted or whether they were enforceable. So we decided to continue with this argument just to ensure that the parole board finishes the process, sees it through, and that they don't abandon the regulations in the future.
Well, you've reviewed, I take it, the board policy and procedure that was approved on March 25th. Does that satisfy your concerns?
Yes, I believe it does. And certainly the Office of the Public Defender would reserve the right to perhaps object or take issue with some of those conditions as they are applied in practice. But certainly overall in general, that policy is precisely the type of formal codified regulations that we had envisioned.
Does the public defender have a position on whether this new policy that we're now aware of qualifies as a so-called internal policy, or is it meeting the Metro Media standard for a regulation affecting the regulated public, impacting third parties broadly, such that it should be subjected to formal notice and comment adoption procedures?
Your Honor, to be honest, I don't have an answer to that question.
You may want to think about it.
Yes, I would just say I believe that we would prefer the more formal process with public notice and the opportunity to comment, just to ensure, you know, certainly we would need to advocate and for our clients and do what we could to ensure that the policy, you know, serves our clients as best as it can.
Understood.
Anything you'd like to add, Ms. Lutz?
Yes, just very briefly. I know the court had some concerns about supervised individuals living abroad who may return to New Jersey. I would point out that if those individuals did return to New Jersey, under Megan's law, they would have to notify law enforcement that they were here once they established residence in the state, so that law enforcement would know when those individuals return to the state. Regarding the question of whether CSL is punitive or remedial, I would point out that the removal statute that governs removal from CSL and PSL strongly indicates that it is a remedial statute. The removal rules indicate that an individual who wants to be removed from CSL, PSL must prove that they're not likely to pose a threat to the safety of others. So they don't have to prove that they have, you know, paid their dues, that they are contrite, that they've served some sort of punishment. They simply have to prove that they're not a risk to the community. So I think the removal statute strongly indicates that CSL is remedial. Finally, with respect to the state's response to the public defender's argument, I would just point out that the state's response is at odds with the court's decision below. JK held that JK had a right to return to Poland. They just said, we're not satisfied that certain conditions were met, but the court never said that he couldn't return. That is what the state is now arguing. So for the state to make that argument, I believe it should have been filed as a cross petition for certification, since it is at odds with the court's decision below. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Schuster.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The threshold question before this court is whether the parole board has the statutory authority to even allow a CSL offender to relocate to another country. But based on the plain reading of the applicable statutes, the answer is no. When the board first reviewed JK's application to transfer his supervision to Poland, the board rejected it based on its understanding that JK would not be under supervision if he resided in Poland. The appellate division then remanded the case and ordered the board to consider whether it could still supervise JK if he was allowed to relocate there. At that time, the board did not stop to consider the threshold issue of whether it even had the authority to permit the international transfer. Instead, the board dutifully complied with the appellate division's remand order and detailed specific information it would need from JK to be able to consider the feasibility of his international transfer request. But JK refused to provide that information, instead arguing that the board was required to let him move regardless of whether he could be supervised. And so the board reasonably denied his transfer request. It was only when the public defender's office filed its amicus brief before this court and asked this court to order the board to promulgate regulations that the board stepped back and reevaluated the statutory authority for such rulemaking. And in doing so, at that time, two things became clear. Number one, no statutory authority currently exists that gives the board the authority to permit an international transfer of CSL supervision. And today, no one has provided any contrary authority to do so either. And two, the cases the appellate division had relied on to find the contrary, Sanchez and JS, have been effectively overruled by more recent decisions of this court. The plain language of the CSL statute mandates that CSL offenders shall be supervised as if on parole. And that responsibility of mandatory supervision falls squarely on the board's shoulders. The only statutory authority the board has to transfer supervision is through an interstate compact. There is no similar authority that allows the board to transfer supervision internationally. Likewise, the board lacks the statutory authority to otherwise unilaterally vacate, cancel, or suspend a lawfully imposed sentence of CSL. Only a judge can do that if the criteria for the 15-year relief valve are met. In short, the board has no authority to allow a CSL offender to relocate to another country under the law as it now stands. And JK's three arguments to the contrary fail. First, the mere fact that someone has dual citizenship does not create an unfettered right of return to that other country, and nothing JK relies on says otherwise. The opposite is true. Second, JK relies on Sanchez and by extension to argue that he's entitled to relocate to Poland regardless of whether he can be supervised. But this court has implicitly overruled Sanchez in its more recent decisions in Perez and Hester, which clearly hold that CSL is an integral part of a defendant's criminal sentence rather than an administrative obligation it can just dispense with. Third, JK's equal protection argument fails because the group of that he complains is being treated better than he is, non-citizen CSL offenders, are very simply not similarly situated. They have not taken an oath of allegiance to the United States to uphold the Constitution and its laws, and they do not travel on a US passport. Citizenship has its benefits, but it also has its responsibilities. If anything, what JK seeks is to have this court hold that as a dual citizen, he should suffer lesser penal consequences than an offender who is just a US citizen. Such a result is untenable. For all these reasons, this court should affirm the board's denial of JK's application to relocate to Poland, expressly disapprove of Sanchez and JS, and reject the public defender's invitation to order the board to promulgate what would amount to ultra vires regulations. And indeed, because there is no authority for regulations, the policy is also outside the board's authority.
And that concludes. Ms. Schuster, I want to come back to the 800-pound gorilla. you want us to declare that what the public defender has asked, that the board promulgate rules, is inappropriate, even though it's precisely what the board itself has done. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, because at this point, the board has realized that although it had been taking steps and moving in the direction of trying to think through ways that it could possibly supervise internationally, that there's no statutory authority for doing it. The agency can't give itself.
When did the board reach that conclusion? Mr. Maynard, in his presentation, told us that the policy had been relied upon as recently as 2 months ago. This litigation has been going on for some time.
Right. Well, it's my understanding that the board, once we review the public defender's submission to this court, that at that point, that the board was not approving applications under that policy. I do not know about.
Was it applying the policy and disapproving applications? And does that not constitute the use of the policy?
It was my understanding, and it's possible that there's something that I don't know about, but it's my understanding that the board was not using the policy the board had been trying to think through ways based on JS and how this court came and how the appellate division came out in this case, that it had to come up with some mechanism for handling these cases, but that once it became apparent that there was no authority, that the board was not moving forward using the policy.
So that's been the legal position in front of this court for quite some time. My question is, when did the board in practice stop using the policy?
Your Honor, I'm happy. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm happy to follow up with a letter to the court, but much like a regulation, a policy that is created without authority is invalid. So to the extent that the board made a mistake in trying to do what the appellate division said by trying to figure out how these international transfers could occur because they thought they had the authority, and then it became apparent that they didn't have the authority. The policy does not just become valid because the board was mistaken.
Ms. Schuster, did your office, through the assistance of a deputy attorney general, assist in the promulgation of this policy? I'm assuming that the board sought legal counsel, just didn't create this out of the thin air.
I want to know
whether or not your office participated in the promulgation of this policy.
I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that the board is in contact with deputies supervisors in a particular section, the Attorney General's office. Whether or not they had robust communications back and forth about this policy, I do not know.
Isn't there a deputy assigned to the deputy or deputies assigned to the parole board?
I imagine that there are, yes. I mean, a lot of different deputies can handle cases that come out. Whether or not one deputy is the only deputy that's assigned, that I'm not aware of.
There's a section chief who supervises the group of deputies, correct? I mean, there is organized management.
Yes, there is organized management, exactly. But there are a number of deputies that, for example, I sit in the appeals group, and so I know of a number of deputies that will file briefs on behalf of the parole board. It's not necessarily one deputy.
But that's why there are assistant attorney generals supervising and reviewing the briefs before they're filed to make sure that inconsistent or inaccurate positions are not being taken, correct?
That is correct.
Would you concede that a major component of CSL is remedial? The purpose of supervision is to protect New Jersey citizens. That's the reason. At that point, the goal is not retributive or even penal in nature. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with part of that, that there is a remedial public safety component, but not that it is solely to protect New Jersey citizens.
I accept that. Not that we would throw someone into another country without advising them of who they were getting, but it's public safety. It's awareness and supervision, correct?
It's awareness and supervision and rehabilitation.
Okay. So assuming that is the remedial goal, and someone is on lifetime supervision in this country and another country has a similar system of at least supervision, would this statute even like withstand constitutional scrutiny if a person was a citizen of another country and basically condemned to remain in this country with no hope of returning to his or her homeland?
Well, CSL, if someone meets the criteria to get off of CSL with the 15-year relief valve, it's not a lifetime supervision. So if they don't violate and they prove that they're not a danger, then it's not
the most, a lifetime. Even the most minor infraction is going to constitute CSL. There are like 26 different requirements, and a single one can lead to a violation. Not calling timely a parole officer, right? Being a couple of hours off could lead to a violation, correct?
It's entirely possible that there are many conditions. Now, whether or not just not making a phone call would lead somebody to not get off of the 15-year.
So this is what I'm trying to figure out, is if you're sticking with the statutory argument that there's this policy is that was issued is somewhat void ab initio, would this statute just not have a rational basis if it did not provide a right of return to a country that was willing to accept that citizen, given the fact that I would think the central purpose of Megan's Law is to protect New Jersey citizens. I'm trying to figure out how New Jersey citizens are being protected by not permitting people to return to their native homes, native countries.
Well, there's a couple responses to that. First, I mean, New Jersey citizens also travel to Poland and here, and New Jersey citizens have relationships with someone like JK in this case, who's been here for over 20 years, that could go and visit him in Poland and potentially have children and family and could be at risk. So the notion that New Jersey is completely protected if JK moves to Poland and isn't under supervision, I think is sort of a false premise.
You don't think that New Jersey citizens are better protected when a person is 5,000 miles away rather than residing in the country, even though under CSL could violate, CSL could victimize other people? You don't think that New Jersey citizens are more protected under those circumstances?
I think that there are certain aspects where they certainly are more protected. And then there's other crimes like human trafficking or child pornography that the lack of his physical presence in the state, it doesn't really turn on his physical presence in New Jersey. But I would agree that for the contact crimes, that there is a lesser likelihood that a contact crime with a child will occur. But I want to just go back to this notion of this fundamental right to return to a home country. And I want to address that because I think that there's sort of this false idea that there is an unfettered right. And there's four points that I want to make on this. Number one, in HR versus the Parole Board, this court recognized that it's well established that it's constitutionally permissible to subject parolees to conditions that restrict their activities beyond the ordinary restrictions imposed by a law on an individual citizen. To the extent that somebody is not sentenced to CSL, they are going to have greater rights than someone who is serving a sentence to CSL. Number two, this notion of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. While it's true that Article 12, Paragraph 1 of the Covenant provides that everyone shall be free to leave any country, and then Paragraph 3 talks about the right to enter one's country shall not be arbitrarily denied. The paragraph in the middle talks about how those rights are restricted. They're subject to restrictions provided by law and that are necessary to protect public order, public health, and morals. So this notion that even in the covenant itself recognizes that law, that there are restrictions by law that cut against that right of return. And also, I think something that's helpful is to look at even just an opinion by the United States Supreme Court in discussing dual citizenship, where they it's Kawakita versus the U.S. 334 U.S. 717, and it's a case where the United States Supreme Court talks about how there is a tension when someone is a dual citizenship because they're subject to the rights and the obligations of both nations. And that American citizenship, until it's lost, carries obligations as well as privileges and benefits. It's not fair weather citizenship.
I'm trying to figure out the point of this. The point, a person is here, okay, and being supervised. Assume that Poland and the appropriate authorities are advised and they say, we're willing to take them. We're willing to take them. Like, why would New Jersey have an interest in demanding that this convicted sex offender remain in New Jersey? I'm trying to figure that out.
I don't know that they do have an interest, but I will say it's a super strong interest, but I will say it is not for the parole board to unilaterally make that decision because the legislature has determined that somebody who is subject to CSL shall be supervised. And the only one that can cancel that, suspend that, has any ability to touch that criminal sentence is a judge with the 15-year relief valve. Now, the parole board, there is a statute that allows the parole board to transfer supervision interstate. And that statute specifically provides that it is the only mechanism that allows the parole board to transfer supervision. There is not a similar provision that allows the parole board to transfer a sentence internationally. Now, this is significant because under the canons of statutory construction, you have to look at the whole statutory framework for parole, and there's no authority to allow the parole board to transfer that supervision.
I want to be clear about something because I want to know what our court is going to be obliged to do here. You're telling us that if we were to remand this to the parole board, the parole board will not consider JK's application under the board policy and procedure that was approved on March 25th. Is that what you're telling us?
At this point, Your Honor, no, I don't see how the board has the statutory authority. I've yet to see. I mean, I think something that's helpful in
I just want to be clear. You're telling us don't remand it, because if you do remand it, he's not going to get any relief under that policy. Is that what you're telling us?
I don't see how he can get relief at this point, unless the court finds that there is, look, the court, Your Honor, is not going to, the parole board is not going to tell the court. If the court directs the parole board to do something, the parole board is going to follow the court's instructions, certainly. But I can't see what the authority is to direct the parole board to do that. Because, for example, in the corrections context, there is a corrections statute that allows for interstate transfers, and there's a separate statute that allows for international transfers. And it specifically gives the authority to the commissioner of corrections to enter into transfers when someone has the, there's a treaty in place and there's the authority. There's no similar international provision or statute that allows for the same thing for the parole board to transfer supervision. So by statute, they shall supervise unless there's a way for them to transfer. And there's no mechanism in place, no statutory mechanism for them to transfer. And what Mr. Maynard is suggesting is that if a someone who's subject to CSL goes to Poland, the parole board is permitted to find out where they're going to live, find out where their job may be. But what he's suggesting is that while he's there, if Poland or anywhere else can't supervise him, well, that's fine. And that's not fine under the statute. He's subject to a criminal sentence where he shall be supervised.
So many other, I don't know if you can help us in this regard, but many other states have similar Megan's Law schemes to New Jersey. Are you aware of how other states handle this issue?
No, I'm not. I was able to find, there is like a uniform, I can't even remember what the document's called. There's a document that talks about international transfers, but the document itself talks about how it's easy to transfer when somebody is in custody, but that transfers of people that are in the community and being supervised in the community really don't work, and they're very difficult, and it's better off if a state will enter into some sort of more, there's not gonna be a giant compact because there's all these different rules and there's all these problems with it. So that's all I was able to see. I was not able to locate another state that has an international relationship where they do these kind of transfers.
Ms. Schuster,
I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I just wasn't able to find it.
I want to follow up on Justice Alvin's question about the practicality of a remand. Last Thursday, there was an email from parole to Mr. Maynard that said the policy is, quote, under review. What we're hearing now is, in effect, the policy has been shelved. Can you clarify?
I think that under review is a vague term that means a lot of things in lawyer speak, which right now I do believe means shelved for the time being, that it's not being actively used because the parole board is waiting on guidance from this court because the parole board is very much trying to act in good faith. It understands that it has shifted positions, but it does not want to try to grab statutory authority or authority that it doesn't have. Now, if this court can identify or someone can identify statutory authority, the board is not opposed necessarily to promulgating regulations or using the policy. I can't really speak to that, but the reality is the parole board's unaware of what statutory authority that its policy would be attached to or any regulations would be attached to.
Can I ask what may be, and it just popped into my head, that's always a dangerous thing. I didn't think of it before, but it occurs to me that there are many immigrants, legal and illegal, who are convicted of Megan's Law crimes. And ultimately they are going to be deported when released, but as part of their sentence, they are CSL. They don't stay in the country. They get made released and taken by ICE and presumably deported. Under what treaty does that happen? In other words, I think technically they're CSL. I believe that none of them are required to be kept here. How is it that those individuals, because they are illegal or even legal immigrants, can, while on CSL, be taken to a foreign country, but somebody with dual citizenship cannot? It just doesn't make sense to me, and I may be wrong. Maybe that's not what happens to a CSL sentenced illegal immigrant.
No, an illegal immigrant, there's a federal statute that allows for them to be deported when they're serving any kind of parole. And that's a federal statute that provides for that. But they are not similarly situated to JK here. JK is a US citizen who has taken an oath of allegiance and has sworn to uphold the Constitution and its laws. And
that would be your answer, but what about illegal immigrants?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What about a legal immigrant? Somebody's here legally, but they've committed an offense and they're going to be deported.
Right. Well, they don't travel on a U.S. passport. So it's...
That's the distinction in your mind.
That is a huge distinction. I mean, the notion...
I'm just saying that's the distinction.
Yes. U.S. citizenship is a big distinction. There are a lot of privileges and benefits that come with U.S. citizenship that remain with someone until they decide to give that citizenship up. And that, based on JK's briefing, is not what he is seeking to do. He is not seeking to give up his rights as a U.S. citizen, but he wants...
If he did relinquish his right as a U.S. citizen, would he be in a stronger position?
As a practical matter, probably, because just because of federal law that provides, I mean, but he also would not then be coming into the United States on a U.S. passport, which if he decided not to
I'm not taking it that far. I was just curious because it just occurred to me, and I understand your answer.
No, I think that's the big distinction, is that U.S. citizenship and the U.S. passport, among the other privileges, is a significant line that makes it not an equal protection concern.
So I'm puzzled just as Solomon is, because if he gave up his U.S. citizenship, in order to get back to Poland, what you're saying is he's better off now just like committing some sort of offense in the United States so that ICE will pick him up and deport him to Poland. I mean, like that doesn't seem to make any sense at all. I mean, he doesn't have a legal means of getting back to Poland, but if he commits some sort of offense, he might be lucky enough to have ICE take him in custody and deport him.
No, I mean, ostensibly he could put in for a travel permit. He has the ability to travel to Poland. There are regulations in place that allow for supervision, and he could travel to Poland. And I can't speak to what the board would do in that situation and bind the board to anything. But the reality is, if he traveled to Poland and renounced his U.S. citizenship, he would be in Poland and not having committed a crime. So he doesn't have to get picked up by ICE and deported or put in jail. But he doesn't want that. He wants to keep his U.S. citizenship. He wants the benefit of being able to move, not under supervision. And he wants to be able to check in once a year on the computer, where he could actually be in Pennsylvania and not in New Jersey, because when you check in over the computer, you could literally be anywhere.
Mr. Maynard hasn't told us that he wishes to keep his U.S. citizenship. I didn't hear that, and I didn't read that. So maybe
I think it's in a footnote, Your Honor.
Yes,
I believe so.
I'm surprised if I missed it.
Ms. Schuster, is there anything you'd like to add to your presentation?
No, Your Honor. I think that covers everything. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.
Your Honor, I'm sorry, but I did reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal in the form that I submitted that asks if you're reserving time.
Ah, always helpful to say that at the outset of argument, please. Go ahead.
Thank you. My apologies. On the question of lack of statutory authority, I think it's important to remember that the lack of a written statute cannot bar the exercise of a constitutional or fundamental right. And as an example, we can look at this court's rulings in Lewis v. Harris, where this court found that there was no statutory authority for granting equal rights to same-sex couples, and yet the absence of a statute violated equal protection. So under Lewis v. Harris at page 463, this court ordered the legislature to adopt such statutory protections. And I think that's a parallel to this case. I think the implementing provisions of CSL give broad authority to the Division of Parole to actually implement procedures for transfers of CSL offenders in interstate or international. So I don't think that they don't have the authority. I think they do have the authority under their implementing statute. But even if they say they didn't, or if this court finds they didn't, you cannot stop or impede the exercise of constitutional and fundamental rights by the existence or lack of a statute. And in addition, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. The idea that you have to, in some way, waive your citizenship or expatriate your citizenship in order to have some ability to make a reasonable, ordered transfer of residence to your country of birth is not the way that we should proceed in a system of organized laws. We need to have a reasonable, organized approach that is codified and that people can understand and rely on and understand what the provisions are, that are is harmonized between the reasonable conditions of eligibility for such a transfer, and by not allowing the conditions of supervision to form a de facto or functional denial. So I think we have to think in terms of reasonableness. We have to keep in mind globalization and the migration of persons and the transportation of people all around the world in hours. The fact that globalization is only going to continue to integrate the world with masses of populations, and we need to have laws, the law evolve to accommodate understanding and the provisions for people who find themselves in one place with potentially a CSL provision that then want to go home. And the fact that parole has been as a part of their system, allowing and facilitating deportation of non-citizens to their countries of origin with no provisions, no conditions, no extradition, I think that tells us where the Division of Parole really is on whether or not they think that it's so critical to have conditions of supervision in place when a CSL offender leaves. That's been going on for a long time, and it's the standard operating practice of the Division of Parole. If we adopt some reasonable codified mechanism that we can put in place, such as the draft of the policy that parole put together with some reasonable, almost marginal additional considerations of equal protection and fairness, I think we've almost solved the problem. I don't honestly know what else to say, but that I think we're almost over the goal line in some ways. But I would suggest that we cannot let conditions of supervision in a foreign country impede the rights, these fundamental rights of people to return home or to live in a place where they have a legal right to reside, while we can put into place conditions of eligibility that would protect the citizens of New Jersey and make for a reasonable, organized transfer. It's like the evolution that was required when we put in the Uniform Act, which then became the Interstate Compact and interstate transfers, because of the movement of peoples in and around the country, there was a need eventually to create a compact that allowed an orderly transfer of people under supervision to go back to the state they came from or to change residence where they had an employment opportunity. And I think we have to construct a similar architecture here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under